Hey, what up, fam? Welcome to another episode. Today, we gonna be talking to our homegirl, Brenda, from God is Great. I think you're gonna incredibly enjoy this person. Her story is amazing. Her new book is amazing. I can't wait for you guys to hear her story, from purity culture to having a hoe phase to everything in between. We get to talk to her as she gets candid and honest about everything that she's been through. I know you guys are gonna enjoy it. Here's Nights at the Roundtable. And welcome to another episode of Nights at the Roundtable. It's your boy, Man Wheezy, with my queen to the left, Angela Johnson.
Hello.
And B to the right.
What's up?
And today, we are excited to have Brenda Davies.
Yeah.
Queen of God is Great.
Let's go.
Author of On Her Knees.
Come on.
What it do, what it is, here in LA with us. How are you?
Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
We're very excited about this.
Are you outside?
Yeah, I'm on my porch because my baby is sleeping inside.
Look at you connecting to nature and being yeah. one with yourself.
You have a baby?
Mm-hmm.
How old is your baby?
He's one.
Oh my gosh, congrats.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, wait till we get into the story. I'm so excited to get into all these stories because that story is pretty amazing.
Her baby story. I gotta hear this story.
But it's funny because we actually quoted your book on
let me tell this part.
Okay.
So you and I connected on Instagram. I started scrolling through all your videos on YouTube, and I was like, oh my gosh, this girl's preaching to my soul. And what I loved most is that Brenda would tackle some really like controversial topics.
Yeah.
And things that would like typically get you like riled up, and where I would probably pop off at the mouth, say something real uneducated. And like, she stays so calm, cool, collected. Like, all her responses are well like thought out and just like with love and grace. Even when she's like giving you like a pow pow, it's still with like love and grace. And I was like, man, I don't know how you do that. I admire that so much. And so when we did one of our episodes of What's One Lie That the Church Sold You, mine was about purity culture, and so I quoted her episode of her YouTube show.
Yeah, I remember that.
From the purity culture stuff. So I quoted you all up in that, and you had a story.
Yeah,
too.
That's crazy. So I didn't even make the connection until now that was Brenda. That's awesome.
Yeah.
This happened maybe like, I don't know. Time moves differently now.
Yeah.
1 month is 3 months. I'm not sure. So it was a few months ago, and Maddie was up. My wife, she was up doing stuff already, and she sent me a link to his YouTube video, and she was like, hey, you got to watch it. This girl's breaking down kind of some of the allegations of abuse that's happening at a major church here in LA. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to watch this and see what it is. And it was one of your videos. And I thought, my God, this girl, one, this is amazing that she's doing this. Mm-hmm. Two, the way that she's breaking this down is like, it's so good. And I'm like, man, I got to watch some more of this girl's videos.
Uh-huh.
And so it was cool because my wife was actually the person who introduced me to your content on YouTube. So super excited to have you here on Nights at the Roundtable today.
Big fans.
I just want to stay quiet and listen to you guys saying nice things about me.
That's literally what this episode is about. But no, introduce yourself to our fans. Tell us what you do and all that good stuff.
In your book, all that.
Yeah, well, thank you for telling me how you found me. That's really, I love hearing those stories. Yeah, so I try to think of the abridged version, but basically I started God is Great out of, like Angela, you were saying, basically storming around my house in fury, like cussing up a storm and being really pissed off. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all started.
So a good prayer session.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's really dope because at the very beginning of God is Great, which came to me very divinely, like through prayer, I knew this was something that I was supposed to do. But in that, I really felt called to be very kind to people in comments and to really frame these disputes, for lack of a better word, or my problems or issues that I have with people or organizations, or not even people, but the theology that people are promoting. with grace and kindness, with the invitation to do better. It's mm-hmm. always about you are effing up royally in this way. However, I'm sorry, I'm the one dragging it out into the light, but this is all about you can do better. I believe in you. And I really try to frame things that way. But it's cool because I just had the 3-year anniversary of God is Gray on Valentine's Day. And I just remember when I started, I was not that person. I was still storming around my house, cussing everybody out, being really pissed off. But kind of the practice of that kindness and the practice of compassion, I looked back and I was like, oh, I suddenly have become actually authentically that person who believes these things. So, yeah, wow. I encourage anyone to do that when you're engaging with a troll or something. Everybody is capable of change, and we should be inviting them to change, even when we're being like, hey, you got something in your teeth.
I love that. I love how it's you aren't canceling people. You're saying you can do better, and then you didn't cancel yourself because you did better, and you learned how to be a genuinely compassionate person.
And I'm sure too, because you're tackling on some big things, some really important conversations to be had. And for some of these people, it's like, you know, they're icons or they're like spiritual heroes. In some ways, they probably feel like you're tearing them down. Mm-hmm. Why are you doing this? You're a part of cancel culture.
You're attacking.
Exactly.
Yeah, I always.
Evangelicals love the persecution complex. They like pulling that out of their back pocket. And I'm just like, dude, you are not being persecuted. You are being called out for some really ill behavior. And to your point, it's like it does get really dark and heavy and sad sometimes. We're talking about sexual assault and cover-ups and abuse and spiritual abuse. And I try to keep it light. That's why I love talking about sex. To me, that can get dark and heavy and sad too. Mm-hmm. But also, it's kind of like my only reprieve with fun to be like, now let's talk about this. But for the most part, it's a lot of like this unveiling. And 2020, I think that was such a major theme, unveiling all of these things, everything in the darkness being brought out into light. And like you said, Angela, not for the sake of canceling, but for the sake of being like, you know, and these people have been unchecked for decades, some of them. Like, look at Ravi, who just died and got outed for being an abuser. You know, it's like the people are in these systems and that are protecting them. And that's what my channel is about, too, because I was so hurt by purity culture, modesty culture, the misogyny in evangelical churches that was all presented to me under the guise of God's will and living in freedom in Christ. And when you really come up against the reality of that, you find that there are systems in place that help harbor abusers or help harbor toxic theology. And there's this great new movement called progressive Christianity, or even deconstruction, even if people don't wind up reconstructing that faith again. But all of it is about tearing, uprooting these structures, whether it be BLM and defund the police or Church 2, Me Too, that are just saying, hey, these seeds we planted are rotten. And we've got to pull out these trees and plant something new.
Yeah, I love that. To give people like some perspective, like I know we got on the phone and we did a pre-call and found out a bunch of awesome stuff that we were literally on the same wavelength, excuse me.
Yeah.
And tell us about your relational background, because I know you said you struggle with purity culture, and I know we were talking on the phone and you were telling me that you were the queen of absolute
tramp aging.
Yeah. Queen virgin of your town, you know.
Oh,
all that.
Yeah,
good stuff.
yeah. So what I was telling Manuel is that I have been the poster child of these two polarities. I was the queen virgin, chaste good girl. When I found out that God cries when you masturbate from a preacher when I was 12.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Oh, man. That's
y'all
that's
know
the
that
rain.
Bible verse.
That's the rain that comes. Anytime it rains, I'm going to be like, oh, somebody's masturbating.
Uh-oh. First opinions, 327, man.
First opinion.
Next time there's a drought in LA, we'll just have to be like, everybody, go masturbate. Yeah. Rain up here.
Time to set it off, everybody.
But, you know, I always explain to people, because I think I've wrestled a lot with, like, how did I end up falling for a lot of these things that were not innately inside of me? Like, I always had a very simple, intuitive connection to divinity since I was a little girl. I prayed to Jesus. I loved the Bible. But there wasn't this, like, pressure and fear, especially when it came to my sexuality or who I was as a woman. Like, I've always been loud and boisterous and talkative and had leadership qualities. Like, it wasn't until I got into evangelical spaces that I realized, oh, all these things about me are, quote, wrong. Wow. I'm doing this wrong. I'm the wrong kind of woman. But at the time when I was 12, I was already, quote, a virgin, which I'm getting rid of that terminology. Now I call it sexual debut when you choose to have a sexual debut. but at the time I was like, oh, well, I can do that. Like, I love Jesus so much. This authoritative figure, this sexy pastor named Pastor Scott with the hookah shell necklace is telling me, telling me, you know, good girls save themselves for marriage and your husband will be super disappointed if you don't do this and Jesus is going to cry, all that stuff. So I was like, no problem. I can do this. This is not a problem. Not a problem at 12 years old. Bigger problem at 17.
Sure.
Huge problem at 21. I was dying to have sex. I felt like I was physically like you'd hunger for food. I was like, my body can't take this anymore. This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So I was the one, though, that had everyone buy the purity rings for, you know, to save themselves from marriage. I organized this chastity ceremony at my church when I was 15,
wow.
which is another reason I have grace for, like, purveyors of toxic theology, mm-hmm. because I was one of those people.
Wow.
Like, I don't know how many people in that group I hurt, that I made them question their worth, you know, like, I was a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But after I ended up, basically, it's the longest story ever, but I was like trying to save myself from marriage. And Angela, well, you were both going to Oasis at the time, right?
I was, for sure. Me and he hadn't moved here yet.
I was going to Oasis in 2010 when I lived here that first stint. Remember? Because I was going with Ricky.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I think I stopped going in like 2009 or 2008, somewhere around there. So I missed you.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I was there, I remember just like scouring the pews looking for other virgins because I didn't know any. And I was just like, who is saving themselves? Like, who out there is doing this too? And all I found was people that were like, oh, well, I wish I had. And I'm like, okay, I'm really horny and that's not helpful. Like, it's just not. Like, they're like, my marriage would hypothetically be better if I had. And I'm like, I can't deal with hypotheticals right now. So I also dove into biblical research because I wasn't about to like throw in the towel on my quote purity too quickly. And then I find out, you know, Solomon has hundreds of wives and hundreds of concubines and David has 12 wives. And
they be having all the sex.
Yeah. I'm just like, where are even the virgins in the Bible aside from these like 12-year-old girls that are Solomon's concubines,
yeah.
you know? So I couldn't really find the justification in the Bible. And let's be honest, I was trying to justify going in the other direction anyway. So I ended up trying to have a one-night stand. I was like, I just need to get rid of this problem. It was just too enmeshed in my identity. I just felt like it had become this like monolith and it was all that mattered. Again, like food, like I also experienced anorexia and it felt the same. It was like I wouldn't allow myself food, so I thought about food 24/7.
Wow.
And sex became the same thing. So I was like, let me just have sex so I can have my life back, so I can have friendships again and, you know, be a normal quote unquote person. But I got in this whole narrative of guilt and shame, and I ended up marrying that one night stand thinking, oh, maybe God sent the one too soon to like save me from sinning. Like all of these mental gymnastics.
Sure.
Yeah.
That makes sense in the culture that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So many mental gymnastics from our culture. But, and then 2 years into our marriage, he admitted that he had been cheating on me while we were dating.
No.
He was on, Yeah, he was on tour with bands and he was sleeping with girls on the road. And I have so much love and appreciation for him, and I don't even care, because honestly, that was the thing that helped kind of like knock me out of these theologies and make me actually start questioning. Because I was like, I was told this happily ever after: be a good girl, say no, 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 wear a white dress, say yes, have a million orgasms, and live happily for the rest of your life.
Right.
And when that narrative falls apart, you're kind of left there being like, why didn't God come through for me? And that's when you have to decide, did God not come through for you, or is this theology a mess? And obviously I ended up feeling the latter were true.
Wow. I have a question. When you first got married, because before you got married, you're like, I just want sex. That's all I can think about. I'm super horny. After you got married and sex was not a bad thing anymore, it wasn't prohibited, did you feel differently, or were you still like, nope, let's go, I've been waiting my whole life for this?
Thank you. That's such a good question, Angela. I know we're promoting my book. This is definitely all in my book. This is a chapter I call Madonna, because when I got married, I feel he had the Madonna whore complex, where I was this perfect virginal queen. And then as soon as we got married and I was coming on to him for sex and I was wanting it more, he told me that it was turning him off. And we almost never had sex when we were married.
Whoa.
Yeah. And then even when I did, it's like in the evangelical script, you could always be doing it less sinfully. Like, oh no, I lusted after another guy. Or I thought about, what if he was a different person for a second? Mm-hmm. Or, oh, are we allowed to watch porn? Or, oh my God, what if someone, whatever. You can always do it better. And there's always that anxiety, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. I've never heard of that. The guy being like, oh, when we were dating and you were like super like precious and holy, now that you're coming on to me, I'm turned off. I've not heard that complex before.
Oh, really?
But I can understand it. And here's why. If you are getting it somewhere else, then it's more annoying. Because it makes you feel worse about yourself. Because typically a guy would be like, I went somewhere else because I couldn't get it at home. I didn't get what I needed at home.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that he had somebody that was constantly wanting to give it to him and he was out getting it, that would just, if I was the guy, I would feel even worse. And I would try to make it, I would somehow try to deflect off of me and onto you so that you wouldn't start questioning, why don't I want it?
Mm-hmm.
And because the reason I don't want it is because I'm already getting it. And it's funner out there. So if I could turn it on you, then it takes all pressure off of like, well, why don't you want it, sir?
Son of a bitch.
Especially if it sounds very, I don't even think that's, I don't know if I would say it sounds very Christian, but I could see where, you know, desiring, or at least how he used it, was that it was better when you were more, I don't know, what, like holy or not dirty? I don't understand. I don't get it.
I don't know. I mean, men are given some weird, interesting scripts about female sexuality and in secularist culture as well. You know, like women, I think we're coming into a brand new, beautiful awakening where we're finally realizing women desire sex as much as men, if not more. Half the times I'm talking to my girlfriends about how they're trying desperately to have sex with their boyfriend or husband and he's just not as into it. So like, I think it's kind of new that we're addressing the fact that we have these similar desires and wants and needs.
I did learn biologically, because I remember when we got married at 30, like my sex drive took a dive. And I was like, what the hell? Like, not on, like, I didn't want it to, because I was like, in my 20s, I was raging. And then I hit 30 and I was like, what happened? I don't understand this. And then I was talking to my close friend who's a physician assistant, and he dealt with the same thing. And he's like, well, you know, men and women are different. Like, as women gets older, I think y'all hit your peak sex drive at 30 or after you're 30, where men, once they hit 30, it starts going the opposite way. Like, our primo is like 18 to 25. Like, where we're crazy
frat boys.
Yeah,
get them while they're hot.
Yeah,
and then it goes down lower. I know I wouldn't say that's for everybody, but that's when he told me, he was like, no, that's kind of normal,
like a general thing.
Typically, guys, as they get older, their drive goes lower, and then the girls start getting higher. I'm like, oh wow, okay, that makes sense.
What made you want to write this book?
Okay, so is this wind too loud now? Dang.
Hey, it's just adding to the nature and beauty of it all. That's what it's
making
doing.
This interview sound very important. So basically, after I got a divorce and everything.
How long did you end up being married?
We were married for 2.5 years.
Okay. And when did he tell you he was cheating?
He told me 2 years in. So I spent about 6 months trying so hard. Can you hear the lawnmower? I'm sorry.
I thought it was an ice cream truck. I thought it was music in the background. That's just us
adding Foley in the background. That's what we're doing.
Sorry, Saturdays are the worst. I can pop inside if it gets too loud. Just let me know.
You're good.
Okay, so it was 2 years in, and then I spent 6 months just trying so hard to forgive him, because then I also had that narrative of I have to forgive and right. I have to move forward, and I felt really ashamed to have a failed marriage. I didn't really want that. I mean, I don't think anyone really wants that. Sure. Not the goal.
Sure.
But when we basically, I described it as feeling like he had this backpack of bricks, like all of his guilt about what he had done. And he just gave it to me one day and was like, hey, you carry it.
Wow.
Yeah, there was no solution. And also, I've been a very sexual being from a very young age. Like, I started masturbating around probably 3 years old, which is pretty common for women especially. So I was like, and even in retrospect, when I look back, I was given the evangelical story of you want the one, you want this one person you're going to be with forever. Mm-hmm. But I remembered my fantasy life before I, quote, got saved at 12. And I used to imagine kissing a boy and then pushing him aside and there'd be a boy behind him, and kissing that boy and pushing him aside and there'd be a boy behind him.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's interesting. Just objectively interesting. I never actually wanted to be with one person. Mm. So that made it even more difficult when I found out that he had added to his numbers, essentially, while we were together, while I stayed and he was my one and only.
Wow.
So I ended up having an affair out of that bitterness and anger.
Wow.
And then that finally was the breaking point where it was like, well, now I'm just like, if I wasn't, quote, sinning before, now I definitely am. This is a disaster. Gotta call it out, call it quits. And from there, I swung, I describe it again as a pendulum swing. I swung all the way to the other side and went deep, deep into hookup culture. And
are you still married at this point?
No.
Okay. And when you had your affair, did you tell him while you guys were still married and be like, well, guess what? I did it to you now. Okay. Boo.
No, I lied my ass off. Moved out, and then I told him.
Oh wow. Yeah, then was I have so many questions. And it's probably all in your book.
Ask away, please.
So when the guy that you cheated with, was this your one night stand that you always wanted, or was this was it a complicated situation? And you're like, well, I'm gonna go cheat then. Let me find somebody. Swipe, swipe, swipe.
Well, we didn't have swipes back then. Oh, okay. I'm aging myself, but we didn't. No, I was actually doing a movie, and it was someone that I ended up meeting in Chicago. So I was out of town. So all the cards kind of stacked up to help me do this thing that I really didn't even believe I was going to do. I remember drinking an entire bottle of wine in this guy's hotel room and still thinking, oh, but I would never do that.
Wow.
And I like warning people about that too, because I think we should all acknowledge our propensity or ability to do something that's not good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, I had this good girl, I'm perfect, I'm perfect. So I couldn't even recognize when I was getting into that territory of danger where I was going to do something that wasn't quite me. And now I look back too, and I'm like, well, the more admirable way to have gone about it would be to have broken up with him, to like acknowledge that I had feelings for someone else and be like, we have to call it quits. But I just wasn't courageous enough at the time. I was too hurt. I was young and like just didn't know how to navigate the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And after you had your affair, did you have the guilt and shame afterwards, even though you knew your husband had also been unfaithful?
That's the really interesting thing, is that I remember when I had sex for the first time and then when I had an affair, I was waiting for all of that guilt and shame I'd always heard about to come. Especially after I lost my virginity, I just remember like stepping outside and just like waiting for God to smite me or something. I was just like, when am I going to feel really, really terrible like everyone's told me I would? And it just never happened. And it's not because I don't have remorse for things. Like, I absolutely do. And I very much care about how other people feel and how I'm behaving. But I also am very anti-shame. I think shame does nothing but like paralyze you and make you unable to move forward and correct, course correct your mistakes. It's about like conviction. Like, I did this thing wrong, so what am I going to do about it, versus wallowing in the what ifs, because it was like, what's done is done.
Yeah. It's good to have that frame of thought, like that idea of what exactly you just said about shame. I think actually acting that out and like owning that is the difficult part, because I could say all day, oh, shame is just going to keep you whatever, but to actually not let shame keep you locked in, like, that takes work.
I talk about it like it's an invitation. Like, I really feel like shame like knocks on your door at certain moments, primarily at like 3 a.m. when you just like wake up and remember some dumb thing you said when you were 17. Like, that's kind of like that invitation, like, hey, don't you want to feel ashamed about this? But it's like an external thing, you know. I think I truly believe that conviction is very internal. Like, when God, because I still identify as a Christian 100%. So for me, when the Holy Spirit's calling me out on something, it's like that ping, and it still hurts. It's like, oh my gosh. It's like a parent or a lover even chastising you and letting you know you went in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. But it's mobilizing. It's like, it's not like I am wrong or I am terrible. It's like, I did something wrong. I did something terrible.
That's good.
How can I correct it? But shame is like your pastor telling you God cries when you masturbate, or you know, someone telling you're a piece of garbage or you're not worthy, and you take that on, and it paralyzes, shuts you down. So it's like, you're right, Angela. It's a practice. You have to be like, no, not accepting that invitation. Just like going to move forward.
That's good. Okay. Bring us back to you guys get divorced.
Yes.
I had to detour for a second. I needed the deets.
No, I like it.
I know there's somebody listening that was also like, but wait, there's more.
And just to confirm, all these stories intertwine into the book. Yeah. This is all what kind of makes the book what it is.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah,
so as she's speaking, if you like what she's hearing, then the book is becoming more appealing. Okay, yes. Go.
Yeah. Angela, actually, your copy will be in the mail soon. Yeah. I got your address. Yeah. After that, I went into what I call a trampage, and that was like,
we call it hoe phase. Yeah.
Yeah, hoe phase, all the same. But my whole thing was like, I've had so much guilt and I've had so many scripts about what I'm supposed to do that I needed to just really break free of that. And I ended up leaving church at that same time because I knew that I wouldn't be accepted with that behavior that I was going to choose willfully to indulge in, but also because I just remember people like wanting to pray for me and encourage me to basically get back together with my husband, or like ask me what I feel about my marriage. And it just felt really loud. Mm-hmm. I was like, I just need everyone to quiet down. I need to be alone so I can really figure out what I'm doing. And the reason I wrote this book truly, and the reason all of this work I'm doing is so important, because I want to be the cautionary tale. I want to have done the things that you should not do, and I can tell you why you shouldn't. And it's not because God will hate you or go to hell. It's because I like really hurt myself in a lot of situations. Because to me, purity culture and hookup culture are the opposites, and they're both negative. I see them both as negative things. That's not shaming people making autonomous consenting choices with their sexuality. Like, to me, hookup culture is using people's bodies for your own pleasure, not really taking into account what they want to experience or what their emotional life is when you leave them worse off than when you found them. You know, you're making people cry, you're not being communicative. That to me is hookup culture. And I was deep, deep in that attitude. Especially as a woman, just believing like, oh, guys are just lucky if they have sex. So I don't need to call him back and I don't need to treat him well because he got laid, whatever.
Yeah.
That's kind of a script we get about gender from all cultures, whether it be religious or secular, which is not right. Sure. I totally disagree with that now. But my whole book and the purpose of my work is to say, let's stay centered. Let's be somewhere in the middle of these like polarities of and extremes. And that can apply to anything. If like finances are your Achilles heel, for me, sex is my Achilles heel. Like everyone kind of has their thing that they can either, it's almost like whatever you're most talented or skilled at or passionate about can either demolish you or help you thrive. And I like am a sex educator because that is my greatest passion, but it's also been one of my greatest heartbreaks. So yeah, I'm hoping to just like lead everyone to the middle where it's like you are creating a sexual ethic based on integrity, not based on purity and not based on whether or not you're going to go to hell, and making decisions from that place.
Love that.
And we can go into the tramp page if you want, but that's a whole thing.
I got a question actually about the title of your book.
Okay.
So the title is On Her Knees, right? So with you talking, for me in this sort of context, I'm thinking like sexually or like religiously, you know, like the on her knees is like praying, and then on her knees is also have the sexual connotation as well. Can you kind of share a little bit of why you named your book On Her Knees?
So brilliantly.
Yeah.
Microphone again.
Oh no.
She's got it.
I don't know why it keeps doing that to me. Okay. That's good, right?
Yep.
Okay. I cannot take credit for this. I'm going to give credit to my amazing friend, Alberto. I was writing the book. I was just getting God is Grace started because I actually began the entire YouTube channel so I could get this book published.
Okay.
And then the YouTube channel became its own thing. So I was just starting the channel. I was like sending out the book to people. And I was modeling at the time, and this amazing, beautiful, gay Italian man named Alberto was just like in a frenzy going around the room, like pinning me into clothes. And I was like, I need a title that's like sex, but also praying. And he was like, On Your Knees. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
All right. So I got it. I got it. Yes.
Yeah. And it's funny because I had to fight for that title with my publisher because we did want it to be welcoming to a large audience. And I do dream of some conservative Christians reading it because there is, like I said, this is a cautionary tale. I'm sure people will find a lot of things that I've done or said offensive or out there. But like, I want people to know what this kind of culture begets. And how this culture can hurt someone in real time over the span of 10 years, how deeply it had hurt me and confused me, and try to offer some balm and some alternatives to that sort of narrative.
Tell me, because this is where our conversation got cut off, which goes into what you were saying. Because when we were having our pre-call, we got into her baby. And she was like, this is how I got pregnant. And I was like, oh no, I've warned people like that.
We need to hear this
just
story.
In talking about, you know, the consequences of wilding out, you know, like it's all real, but how she handled it is pretty amazing. So tell me the story that I didn't get to hear. Tell us.
So basically, again, with the channel,
I had gone on this like 10-year probably deconstruction of my faith on my own, and I didn't have that terminology at the time.
Right.
I didn't know there was going to be this glorious, gigantic community of people mm-hmm. holding me when I finally came out and said these things. So I called it my prodigal son journey. I just considered myself that. And I was like, mm-hmm. one day I'll come back. Hopefully I don't die beforehand and go to hell. Like that mm-hmm. was kind of where mm-hmm. I was with it. And then I started looking at all of, I was writing blogs and journal entries about my experiences. And I was like, I think I should turn this into a book and see if other Christian girls have experienced this. And basically on that journey, I ended up watching a lot of YouTube videos of other Christian girls hoping to find a sex positive community or an LGBTQ affirming community. And instead I found the same toxic theology that had really ruined elements of my life and really broken me. And my final straw was this girl saying that God is her birth control. And this is like an affluent girl, like white chick in her home, like plenty of space behind her because her house is big. And I'm like, yeah, of course God can be your birth control. You're not a mother of three in like downtown Los Angeles. Like that is a very privileged, ridiculous, unfounded, unbiologically accurate thing for you to say. And I ended up, like you said, Angela, at the top, storming around my house, cussing this girl out, freaking out. mm-hmm. And that's when it like hit me. Like it was a very like divine moment. I was just like, God is great. Get your camera, do your own thing.
Yes. And you were your own answer.
Yes. So that said, I was still in toxic relationships occasionally. I was still sleeping around whenever I wanted to, but I was also coming to terms with the fact that I didn't want to really live like that anymore. I was like, there's got to be a sexual ethic that makes more sense than this. This isn't working. I want a family. I want real love in my life. Like, this is not it. Just dealing with like fuckboys all the time.
Yeah.
And when I stepped out and put out my first episode, at the time I was just sleeping with a best friend of mine because that's just what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And a really pivotal, beautiful moment is I read Linda K. Kline's book, Pure. And are you guys familiar with her at all?
No.
Oh my gosh, you have to get it. She basically researched 12 years of people that survived this evangelical purity culture. And she has all their stories in this book and talks about basically what it did. And it outlines like suicidal ideation, erectile dysfunction, vaginismus, like real consequences to this theology.
Wow.
And at the very end of the book, she said something kind of like, I realized that I had compartmentalized myself. Like my sexuality was here, my spirituality was mm-hmm. here, and that God was never invited in my bedroom. So she describes an experience where she had finally decided to align herself and basically be like, God, I'm having sex. Get in this room with me, which for any non-spiritual person probably sounds insane, but it's just really about that integration of like, you cannot cast parts of yourself aside, especially when you're in a situation as precious and vulnerable as a sexual scenario. Like you need to be integrated. You need to know your worth. Mm. You need to know what you deserve and advocate for yourself in those situations. And you can't do it when you think God hates you, or you've left him outside of your bedroom because you're not worthy. And wow. I have stories of like where that led to that are really depressing. So I heard Linda K. Kline said, God, get in here. And I practiced the same thing. Like the next time I had sex, it was with this dumb fuckboy that I knew he was. And I felt that thing in my spirit. Like while I was getting into the situation, I was like, this is dumb. And God was like, this isn't it. We don't like it. But I did it anyway without the shame for the first time ever. Cause I was like, I'm just going to be whole in this moment and see how it feels. Like actually, like my friend Jamie Lee Finch is also incredible. She wrote this book called You Are Your Own mm-hmm. about embodiment and staying in your body and honoring your body. Isn't a flesh piece of trash. It's your vessel mm-hmm. from which you are living this life and it deserves honor. So I took all of that in the bedroom with me. And then my desire for that just like dissipated, honestly. And I know it might not happen as easily for everyone, But that's really like a pivotal shift for me. So I was still sleeping with my best friend because it was a great relationship and it wasn't doing me harm. You know, we love each other. But I ended up getting pregnant out of wedlock, and that just became the next thing on my journey. And I was so scared because at the time, God is Gray was building, and I was like, oh God, do people think I'm like this saintly, like perfect thing? They don't know I'm still hoeing around. They don't know I'm sleeping with my friends. But they all really embraced me, and it's been incredible. And it's also just opened up other people to tell me their stories and be like, same thing happened to me. Like, it happens. But again, this is why sex education and, you know, a lack of shame is so important, because you don't want to get pregnant. There's ways not to, and people should be aware of that.
Wow.
How old is your, is it son or daughter?
It's a son. His name is Valentine. He just turned one in December.
Oh, wow. Adorable. So he's fresh.
Are you and your best friend still best friends?
I mean, we're always going to be best friends for sure. Like, I think we've locked each other into our lives forever, whether we like it or not. I mean, quarantine's been really wild. It's been really interesting, like parenting and being in small quarters and figuring that out. But like, everything feels really good and aligned. Like, I just feel like I'm in alignment and I know what I'm doing and I know how to respect myself and others. And, you know, it doesn't make any of your relationships perfect. Things still ebb and flow, but essentially we're really good, and I think we'll always be good.
What was the reaction from your family like when you first started your deconstruction phase, even though you weren't calling it that? Like, even for myself, I didn't call it deconstruction because I didn't know of that term. I just would say, I'm asking God questions right now. Like, that's what my answer was. I'm just asking God some questions right now. What was the reaction response from your family and close friends in that Christian community when you first started to ask your questions and go prodigal out?
Oh, you know, they were totally chill. They believed in me. No shame, no fear. No, it was honestly all like, well, I'll see you in hell. Like,
shoot.
There's so much anxiety in this realm of Christianity. And I get it. Like, we've all been given the narrative of hell and eternal damnation. And I know people are afraid themselves to ask these questions. And you're not allowed to ask questions either. Like, you're not allowed to go to your pastor and be like, hey, look at this verse about homosexuality. Do you think da da da? It's just like, no, we're not talking about that. This is not what we're doing. We're this kind of church. So I think we all know this, and that's another reason why I left Oasis at that time, because I knew that environment wasn't going to be a safe space for my deconstruction. And I have my issues with them, but like, you know, I can't say anything. I don't have anything too bad to say about it. It's just like the culture of that kind of church is pretty standard. The most hurtful thing to me, though, was my dad, because I was always my dad's golden girl. There's four of us, and he never even, like, hid the fact that I was his favorite. And it's because I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke, and I didn't have sex, and I was, like, perfect. And all my other siblings were the opposite. So I was just the golden one. So it has been really, really hard for him to watch me deconstruct, because it was, like, I think he really thought he was losing me to hell. He thought he was losing me to Satan. Like, one time he said he had a nightmare that I went on the Conan O'Brien show. And
you went into the pit of hell.
Yeah. And then he was like, apparently Conan was like, do you believe gay people go to hell? And I said, no. And my dad said, and then I saw the audience and Satan was there laughing. And I was like, Dad.
Oh, man.
You know what's interesting, though, then? So your other three siblings, were you not as close when you were super holy? And then when you became, you know, human, did you now find more space with them? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, did it go from you and your pops and mom being awesome because you were considered the golden child, and your siblings were like, you know, they could see that you were favored because you were, you know.
Her dad was probably so mad at her siblings. Like, what did you do to her? Look what you did.
And corrupted her.
Are you closer with them now? You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's really funny because they were corruptive in that when they always tell this story, we're like 15 and 13 years apart, me and my two older ones. So when I wasn't sleeping when I was a baby, they said they blew weed into my crib to make me sleep. Oh. So that's them, and I love them. But I've always been closer to my younger brother because we're only 4 years apart, so we've just had more intimate time together, obviously, growing up that way. My brother and I have always been best friends, super cool, like no judgment.
Cute.
And weirdly enough, when I've come out with all of this deconstruction and even God is gray, my older brother especially is really scared, and he's kind of like taken on the stories and, you know, this like thing we were passed down from our own dad, who was passed down from his parents, like fear, fear, fear. Wow. You got to be afraid. You might go to hell. And I think it's brought a lot of fear up for him. So I'm going to send him a copy of my book too. And hopefully, I don't know.
You're all skip the tramp age chapter. And
let's read pages 1 through 10 and 200 through 230.
The conclusion.
Man, but that's good. I mean, at least you're finding common ground with your family on different levels. Do you think your parents will read the book?
Unfortunately, yes.
Your dad's going to have mad notes.
I've been dreading this ever since I started writing it. Dreading it. Like, I hate it. I'm like, can I just never see you guys again after you read this?
This
like,
is the equivalent of an actress doing nudity and her dad having to see
that.
Yeah. Having to see the.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is it.
Yeah.
And all his buddies too.
Like, yeah.
Hey, I saw your daughter's new movie.
It was good.
Yeah, what do you say about that? And I enjoyed it.
Well, good thing this is a book, and the odds are that his friends aren't going to read this.
Right.
I certainly hope not, yeah.
I mean, I saw a video you did with your dad where it seemed like he was respectful of your journey. You guys were having a conversation where you were on different opinion, and your brother was in it, I think. And it was like he would pose a question and then you would have your answer and your dad would have his answer. And you were showing how you could be like polite in on opposite ends of a topic. But your dad seemed like he was okay with your journey. I'm sure that's taken a while for him to get to that place.
Yeah, it's just been a really long, hard road. Like, that's us at our best. And there's so much love at the foundation of our relationship that is undeniable. And he thinks I'm like super smart and wise, and I will theologically like debate him on things and ended up helping him like pivot on certain things.
Yeah.
And I still think, yeah, there's just still, he's 80, by the way. He just turned 80. So like any kind of change, any kind of like teaching an old dog new tricks that I have done in my life, I'm just like, honestly, I just commend you for being malleable at such an old age. Like, he is not a stick in the mud refusing to move. But we've had knockdown, drag out, crying in a restaurant, like fighting with him about primarily LGBTQ stuff. I remember one time I was crying so hard about George Zimmerman and screaming at my dad because he was not. And I don't even want to get into that. Like, it's so crazy to me. He taught in inner city Philly, all Black and Puerto Rican students, his entire career. And then he also watches Fox News and takes on their narrative of like property damage and stuff. And I'm just like, we're going to close these topics. Like, these are off limits topics. We cannot talk about BLM. We cannot talk about Trump. Although I'll talk about him all day now that he's gone.
Hey.
But the thing that saves our relationship is like, we are not discussing these things. And I know that's not always great because you would like to move the needle, but I'm never going to move that man's needle enough for him to like vote for Bernie.
Right.
So it's like, what's the point?
Yeah. There's sometimes you got to just draw that line with family. I'm the same way with my dad. He has more conservative opinions than I do. And so we just have topics that we don't talk about. Every now and then we'll joke. And like during the election, I would throw him some Trump jokes and he would throw me some Biden jokes and we would laugh. But once we actually start talking seriously about, you know, policies and stuff, then it's like, okay, we can't do this conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you mentioned like at least three or four times in this interview, LGBTQ. And what happened in your life that all of a sudden it became a priority to you? Did something personally happen as far as like your sexual spectrum, or you just ended up hanging out with a bunch of, you know, gay friends and all of a sudden you're like, I love these people?
Well, I've always been a theater nerd and an actress, and my best friends all through school, like, came out of his mother's womb with like rainbows flying out. Like,
right.
Right. There's no way around that. And that's why too, like, just that foundationally, I was like, no, people are born gay. Like, he was born gay. There's absolutely no way he was ever going to go for a woman. But yeah, it was just those interpersonal relationships. And I know a lot of straight allies that is definitely the thing that breaks them, because it's such a point of cognitive dissonance in church. If you say God loves unconditionally, we're made in God's image, but if two dudes love each other, they're both going to burn in an eternal damnation. You're just like, how do I mix these two things? And then when it gets really dark and heavy and you talk to friends who have experienced suicidal ideation, or there's even people we've lost to suicide in that community because of this Christian rhetoric. I think it's for a lot of us, it was the issue that kind of pushed us and was like, actually, I left Oasis. I remember it distinctly because it was in 2008 and the pastor was telling us to vote. I know it's confusing. It was like against gay marriage, against Prop 8, which I think was a yes or a no. I don't remember. But that was actually the main reason I left that church.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I couldn't justify it theologically at the time. I just knew. I was like, and I say this like when I think about parenting or something, it's like, why do we tell our sons and daughters, if you walk down an alleyway and you get a terrible feeling in the pit of your stomach and you get goosebumps, listen to your body, follow that. Like, you need to run. Your body is telling you to run. But that if you go into a church space and feel that same sinking in your stomach and you hear a doctrine that you're like, that can't be right, and your whole body tenses up, no, you're wrong. Like, why is that true? I don't think that's true. I think we intuit the spirit and we do know. And you can theologically argue that being gay is a sin, and you can theologically argue that it's not a sin. To me, it does have to come down to, does this make sense on a cognitive real level? And it doesn't. We can't keep hurting people like this, and there's no good alternative option. You can't just say, oh, stay celibate for your whole life, don't worry about it. Like, what kind of resolution is that?
It's funny because there's a guy that who is it that I know that wants to introduce me to this person? I forgot his name, but he was a man that was he goes around preaching now. He is currently single, but was gay, and now he still is.
He calls himself ex-gay.
I don't know if he's that. I really got to remember who the person is that told me that wanted me to get him on the podcast. But he goes around preaching and telling people, I'm still very much gay. I'm just choosing to live this way. You know,
that exists.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. it's. I have to remember that's who told like me because I have to get this guy on and talk to him.
Cy Rogers. Remember Cy Rogers? Oh, yeah,
Cy. Cy was brilliant.
Didn't he pass away?
Yeah, he passed away last year.
Did he?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
He was brilliant. I heard him talk once and I was like, whoa, this guy is brilliant.
Dude, he was like, yeah, he was brilliant. Like, just even just some of the stuff he's breaking down of his understanding of culture and everything, you know? Yeah, it was interesting because I remember hearing him years ago talking about, like, how he felt like God brought him out of that lifestyle, but the remnants of that lifestyle, he's like, I'll never get rid of this. And he didn't really go into detail, but I thought that was interesting because, like, you know, you'll hear some people are like, God save me. I am no longer attracted to the same sex. And then you just kind of feel like, really? Really?
I don't know if Psy ever said that either. I don't think he
did. I don't remember what his his stance was, but I do remember I went to a church here in LA, not the Oasis, a different church. And I brought one of my gay friends. And this is my friend that I've known for years from the Bay Area, very big radio personality, very much out gay man. And he was in LA for whatever reason. So I invited him to come to church. And he actually came. He said, yeah, I'll come with you. I was like, oh my God, he's going to come with me to church. And so I pick him up at his hotel. We go to church. And I kid you not, the pastor says from the pulpit, gay people will not enter the kingdom of God. Gay people are going to hell. Wow. And my stomach dropped, like my throat, like my body tensed up. And I was like, I like couldn't breathe. And I just leaned over to him and I was like, that's not true. I don't agree with that at all. And we got up and left. And I was like, nah, I think I'm done going to this church now. And I don't go to that church. I haven't been there in years and years and years. But I, same kind of thing, like the LGBTQ issue in the church for me is the one that really propelled me to start asking questions. The fact that my family members and my friends were not accepted and were not, quote, going to this place called heaven. They were going to a place called hell where you burn and for all eternity. Like, imagine like an hour of burning. Well, think of like 24 hours of that burning and then like years and years, just eternity of years and years of your skin melting off pain because you're gay. I'm like, really? That's God? I don't like that God.
Hey, a billion years in. Hey, did you learn your lesson yet?
Yeah. You should have not been gay, huh?
Right? You're just thinking of like, oh man, this God whose mercy endures forever.
Yeah.
It was truly the kindest, most generous, accepting person. Like, you know, it's like even the hardest heart can't turn down that kind of love.
Yeah, that was the thing that I really was like, I'm gonna start asking some questions. I don't subscribe to this. I don't like this. Something's wrong. Yeah. And then I would always get like, well, I don't have like I can't debate people theologically. And I'm just like, well, I just don't believe it. So I think you're wrong. And I would rather stand on the side of love than be, quote, right. So I guess we're all going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I've seen
the narrative change, too. Like, I hear everything you're all saying. Like, I remember growing up, the narrative was it's gay to be or it's a sin to be gay.
Right.
And then the church was like, oh, no, we have to soften this up because gay conversion therapy has a 99.9% failure rate. Many argue that 0.1% doesn't even exist anymore. So then the church had to catch up. So they changed it to, oh, it's not a sin to be gay. It's a sin to act on homosexual tendencies.
Wow.
It's a lifestyle and you're not born that way. If science ever proves that you are born with a certain, you know, genetic disposition, then they're going to have to change the narrative again.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's just all this catch up. But to me, the main huge, huge problem is like twofold. One, the Bible says, look at the fruit. We planted the fruit or the seeds of this doctrine of anti-LGBTQ, or you have to be in a heterosexual union. And it's grown into people killing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So look at that. And then the second thing is like, so many people will dismiss it and be like, well, then you just are celibate, or you just, you know, have a heterosexual union, and God will give you the strength. Don't worry. But then you get into that compartmentalization I talk about. I was so fascinated when I learned that the root word of Satan means the divider. When I learned that, I was like, whoa, every time we're divided, whether it be ideology or like ideology, oh my God, I can't say that word right now, in our ideology, or if we're arguing with someone about politics and we're divided in the church, we're divided on all of these points, that in its truest term is satanic. It's division. And when you are satanically divided in your body, that is me going into bedrooms, having sexual situations, and compartmentalizing. It's the division again. So if someone is denying this inherent, like, fundamental part of themselves, and like turning it away and trying to deny it and trying to white knuckle it through life and not be that person who's holistically 100% in it, in their body, in their desire, in their spirit, all of it, then you have a divided person. And I truly believe that's what leads people to be in all of this turmoil and all the suicidal ideation you hear about. If it was that easy, if it was that possible, if God was that gracious to give you the strength to never have sex with a man or a woman when you're not supposed to, then, you know, it wouldn't feel this hard. It doesn't make sense. Like, none of it just logically makes sense. And that's why I'm with you, Angela. It's like, you know what? I just don't believe it's true. I don't believe a God can be all loving, all powerful. I do not believe we can be made in his image and yet be made with something fundamentally, quote, wrong with us. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't add up.
The math don't work.
It's a tough, there's so many sides to these stories. And I think the most important part is making space for all the stories to be told without feeling afraid of where somebody lands. I was talking to somebody on Facebook, and the dude was like, he told me, I mentioned something in one of our teasers, and he said, literally his words were, I don't have to, oh, here it is. It was the sex one because we had the conversation and it was one where I was like, we took questions and we answered the question about bad sex in a marriage. And the guy said, but why surround yourself with people that do not hold the same values? I don't want to argue, but I also don't need to respect your opinion if you have a disgusting view on life.
Okay.
And so I was like, oh, you lost me at, you don't need to respect me because I have a disgusting view, because you're determining what is disgusting in my life according to what's disgusting in your life. And you just finished confessing that you don't need to respect people that you find disgusting. And I asked him, I'm like, what are you so afraid of that someone else thinks a different way? Like, why does that offend you so much? Why does that bother you so much? I would understand if that person came into your house and put a gun to your head and was like, you better be gay or else you're going to die. Then you can be then you could be offended. Be offended by it. Be upset. Be like, oh man, I don't want to do this. You know, but if someone's going about their life doing what they feel is right to them,
What is our
fascination with condemning them? And we use righteous words and like, oh, you have to defend the gospel. You have to stand up for what's right. You have to speak the word. And I'm like, defend the gospel with what? Our frailty? With our constant need of saving? With our inaccuracies? With our inabilities to stay sinless for just one day? Like, what exactly are we defending the gospel with, you know? For me, I'm like, the best defense of the gospel is Christ himself. We point people to him. Not to ourselves, because if we pointed them to ourselves, it'd be like, hey, just so you know, there's somebody that did it better than me. Try not to focus on what I'm doing. Just, you know, focus on what I'm saying. You know, it's like I struggle. And the only reason is because I used to be this. I told you on our pre-call, I used to be that person that was very adamant that I needed to be able to say whose side each person was on. It's like, I feel like we have this innate desire to walk through life and put people on either side of the line. The rights and the wrongs, the holies and the not holies, the going to heavens and the not going. Like, we need to know. And then I ask sometimes people, why do you need to know? Like, what does it benefit you? Do you feel like you stand taller because you're on one side or the other? Do you feel like better than the other person? Do you feel, what is it? What emotion drives the need to know or the need to proclaim who is going to heaven and who is going to hell? Because the only emotion I can feel is ego. There's an ego in claiming to know, in being a person that decidedly wants to tell someone their inevitable future, like their ongoing, never ending future. I need to be able to tell you that your eternity is going to be this. So that way I feel more secure about my eternity. I don't know. Yeah, I can't come up with a good answer.
I have a thought to that. That yes, there's the ego thought of it, but I think also it's that sense of security that people have, that I know I have it. Like, I just want to get things right. Cause if I know that I'm doing it right, then I can relax. Because I am doing it right. I'm doing my part. I got my routine. 1 + 1 = 2. We're good. As long as I keep doing 1 + 1 = 2, I'm good. And I got it right. And it's that sense of security that even if something goes wrong, then you put all that trust in your 1 + 1 = 2. Well, I'm doing it right. So eventually everything will work out for the good to those who love God. 1 + 1 = 2. And it's that sense of security that I think people hold on to. So if you're doing something that is opposite of my 1 + 1, but you're claiming that you believe what I believe, then that makes my sense of security like up in the air a little bit. Like, no, wait, you can't be getting different results of your 1 + 1 than I have, because then I could be wrong. Hold on. No, I need to be secure. So I feel like it's like ego, but then also like people wanting, like grasping for safety and security to know that they're doing it right.
Yeah, I had a friend hit me, and check this, I'm reading this book, which I told you about, Peter J. Gomes, and in this book, I posted it on my Instagram story, and I said something to the point of that the Bible was written by men, right? But it wasn't literally God. Like, the Bible was not literally God, because making it literally God is making an idol of it. And I never heard that like idea. And I started like just sitting with that, and I'm like, man, what does he mean by that? And as I read on in the book, what he was saying was that we have taken this book and have made it literally God to the point where we're afraid of it. We use it as a weapon, and we use it as an actual, like, this is God, as opposed to acknowledging, no, there is a God. There was a God that walked this earth. He's not this book. This book is from the people of God trying to remember their God, trying to teach about their God,
and trying to make sense of him,
trying to connect with him.
Yeah.
But it wasn't for God that this Bible was written. It's not like God is up there like, man, without this book, how the hell are people going to know about me?
Like, God's the publisher.
Like, and so when I posted, my friend was like, oh, you know, I don't know if I agree, because, you know, the word is more than God. You know, the Bible says in John that the word was God and it became God and be flesh, and, you know, and da 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 da. And I was like, yeah, bro, that word in the Greek is logos. You know, it's a masculine noun. You know, it's not a verb. it's a noun, meaning the word. You're using it in Americanese, saying the word, because we call the Bible the word. Uh-huh. So you're telling me that that's what it's talking. It's not talking about that. It's talking about the word in a masculine noun, a noun, a person, place, or thing, a noun. And it's literally meaning something that speaks, like a declaration, you know? So when God was present in that introduction of the world, which where he says he spoke things into existence, that's what he was talking about. The book didn't exist. And even when Christ was walking around, the book that didn't exist either. Like, it wasn't put together yet. None of it was. They had a Torah. They had a law book for good Jewish people, but not for the world. They just had a Jewish book that taught them how to do this and how to not do this. It was very much a rule of law that you got punished if you didn't follow these rules.
So I could try to really grasp what you're saying, that God being the verb. No, God is the noun. The word was a noun. I'm trying to understand that.
When
that
it says picture. The word was with God and the word was God.
So is it almost like in the beginning was the word, like because things were spoken to in existence? If now we get into energy and quantum physics type thing, like it's spoken vibrations and particles, like God is that energy in the word, and that's what it is. God is the word.
Mm-hmm.
He's
the one that's speaking it. If he's the creator of all things, you know what I'm saying? So when it says in the beginning was the word, so we believe in Christianity that God is the one that created it out of nothing.
Okay.
There are certain people that believe that it was a substance, that there was matter. So in the Apocrypha, it teaches this, that there it was the earth and everything was matter, and then God molded the matter into something. Mm-hmm. We believe that God spoke it into existence out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So
and that's the word.
That, he was it. Yes, the word that the was Bible. Spoken. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. From my understanding and reading, you know, going into the Greek, I don't speak Greek, so there's probably even more nuance.
Sure.
But in me breaking it down in my understanding, so the reason I say all that is because we're talking about how close people keep, how some people idolize the Bible with theologically feeling like that's what we've been taught. We've been taught to respect the Bible more than each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my question, you know, in what we're talking about now, that's why I bring it up, because I feel like more people have reverence to a book than to creation that the book was written to save.
Yeah.
To tell the story of this almighty God that loves you, that wants to save your life, but don't freaking mess with this book. This book is our God to us. And at least that's how I saw it. Mm-hmm. This is the living word of God, meaning like this is him, but no, him is him. Because if this book was supposed to be that thing that we worship and idolize, which it wasn't, because he never told us to. When he came to fulfill the word, he didn't do away with it, but he just taught us how to do it in a human way. This is how you do it right, you know?
Yeah, Richard Rohr, he talks about this of like life is like, you're like on this tricycle and that front wheel is your own personal experiences. Mm-hmm. Like the life that you live, these memories, these things, the mistakes you make. And those two back wheels, one is scripture and the other is church history.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things that all go together. For a lot of people, it's like they're either trying to ride that unicycle or it's a bicycle, and they almost take their own personal experiences out of the play. And they realize why this bike can actually go far and it's hard to ride. It's because you're actually denying yourself the humanity.
Right.
Like your humanity, that thing, your experiences are always going to be that front tire that directs you where you're going. And these other things help support that and help give you perspective in the midst of that.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Shout out Richard Rohr.
Come on, Rohr.
Come on, Father Richard.
Anyways, I'm sorry. We got into the biblical stuff.
No, I love it.
But it was something that you brought up, what we were talking about concerning your book, which I'm very excited for you because it's hard to even just get, it's hard to even start the idea of wanting to do a book. I feel for most people, whenever they say they want to write a book, I see on their face the absolute daunting task that it is. So I want to say super like congrats and kudos for you even writing it. Even more so that you completed it and you're proud of it. When is it dropping or is it already out?
It's up for pre-sale, which can really change an author's life. If anyone was vibing out with me, please get it today. That'd be amazing.
Oh, we'll put, we'll put in Barnes &
Noble, Amazon. It's called On Her Knees. Not to be confused with a lot of the like erotica of the same name. Amazon has like amazing titles and it's just like black and white, like sexy.
Nice. Not that one. We will put the link so that they don't get confused. We'll put the link in the description because I like, think they're gonna love it.
I'm so excited for you in this book. And
thank you.
And just,
and it comes out on April 6th, so it's almost here. Awesome.
April 6th. Oh, yes. Snaps. This book will change people's lives, will help so many people.
I hope so.
Let me write this down so I can make sure that,
especially like people who maybe haven't asked the questions or become the prodigal son or start their deconstruction, like whatever it is, but you've always had that intuition of like something doesn't feel right. And I feel like you just sharing your story is really going to unlock some things for people, and it's really incredible. We're so grateful for you coming on our podcast, sharing your story, promoting your book. You've blessed my life with your videos and Maddie, Brandon's wife. And I hope everybody listening right now, go subscribe to her YouTube channel, God is Gray, her Instagram page, God is Gray, and check out her book. If you've jived with anything that we were saying here, there's, she has so many other topics and videos and things that are just really, really insightful.
I will put all the links in the description, so it will be super easy to find her. And if you enjoyed what she had to say, let us know if you guys want to have her back.
Yeah.
And we shall. And we'll dive into sex talk, which we should. We should just make it a thing because our sex podcasts are always are always popular. So we can get into
that'd be
it.
That would be really fun.
That would be amazing. Okay. Well, thank you so much again for taking time. And like we always like to say, we pray that you find a seat at the table. But if you don't, you are always welcome at ours. Cheers.
Cheers.